Broadcasting live from South Texas, this is your Petardcast. I am your host, Mr. Leonard Pierce, welcoming you to the Viking funeral of internet comedy. I hope you'll stick around for the next 45 minutes of something you will look back on and say, I don't even know what the hell that was. Today is the Petardcast's fifth episode, and joining me will be the lovely and talented Ms. Olivia Todd, who is a New York lady of fashion. She'll tell you everything you need to know, present you with some amusing sketch-based comedy, and be put into an awkward philosophical position. In addition, we'll be bringing you even more tidbits, celebrities are our betters, and things that fell out of my brain and moldered behind a radiator for several years. All that and more, a wishy little wish and a dreamy little dream coming out of a violent exit wound on tonight's Petardcast. We start off, as usual, with a selection from my long-running New York Times column, Tidbits, in which I provided various and sundry pieces of advice for various and sundry Americans. This piece is from 1984, 5 years before the column was abruptly canceled, and it was a time when a sudden influx of French egg-based pastry products was causing otherwise perfectly normal heterosexual American men to question their authenticity. There seems to have been a lot of discussion lately about what real men do and do not do. As a 100% real man made of meat, I feel that I have undeniable credibility in this matter, and I therefore present the first of an occasional series delineating the acceptable actions of real men and what things one might do that would lead to exclusion from the fraternity of real men. Real men smell like one of six things: motor oil, sweat, hair tonic, gunpowder, a wet dog, or a variety of body sprays that make women want to have sex with you in elevators. Real men may not smell like anything else for more than 10 minutes, or they risk losing their realness. At no time may they ever smell like daffodils, furniture polish, cat litter, gazpacho, herb butter, or another man's penis. Real men play football, hockey, basketball, car racing, or baseball, hitters only. Under no circumstances do they play high-lie, curling, soccer, track and field, or savate. They are allowed to play lacrosse if they are occasionally accused of raping a stripper. Real men do not come from France, even if they are Alain Delon. They are also, as a rule, not Chinese. Real men must constantly worry about the state of their penis. They should experience no shame in purchasing growth pumps, Freon sprays, or medication designed to artificially generate an erection, even if they are not having sex with anyone, because the only thing more important than tending to your penis is sports. Money is number three, which is why if you have angst about penis insufficiency, it is desirable to spend lots of money on penile improvements. Whether or not they work is beside the point. A $300 a day Cialis habit shows that your priorities are properly calibrated. Immediately upon a real man's reaching the age at which his head begins to resemble his penis, naked on top with a fringe of hair around the bottom and somehow smaller than it used to be, he should purchase an expensive red convertible sports car and drive it around everywhere with the top down. Many people believe that skill in the art of cooking is a mark of a non-real man, and that the only food preparation techniques with which a man should familiarize himself are cooking a chicken with the aid of a beer can, ordering food laced with sexual innuendo from a Hooters waitress, and criticizing the hamburger grilling techniques of others. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, all of the great chefs are men, just as all of the great everything else is are men. Those who worry that a career in the culinary arts might sully their realitude by the acquisition of terms like julienne and the ability to create a radish rosette may rest assured that once you reach a certain level, the duties of a chef largely involve purely real man activities like screaming at your incompetent underlings, making lots of money, and pointing out how you are better at your job than any woman. Some people will tell you that there is something non-real man-ish about spending a lot of money on home furnishings. This is patently untrue. It is only non-real man-ish to spend a lot of money on tasteful home furnishings. Many young urban real men fret unnecessarily over their inability to own property. There is no reason to let a temporary sojourn in the realms of the lower tax brackets prevent one from expressing his realness. Even without the ability to obsess over property values, strive for perfectly level grass height, and stand around saying chummy things to working-class repairmen, you can still make it perfectly clear that you are real. Constantly pore over the real estate listings as if you knew what they were saying. Feign an interest in professional boxing. Cultivate the friendship of ethnic minorities who work in warehouses. Speak knowingly of load-bearing members. Make a weekly pilgrimage to Home Depot. Now is a perfect time to make a stud finder joke. Develop an expensive cigar habit and gesture menacingly at things with them. At this rate, no one will ever suspect you are still a renter. A common misunderstanding among real men and those who would be real is the purpose of drinking alcohol. All too often, a social faux pas regarding what to drink and why will cause embarrassment, intoxication, and whispered comments of your love of glee. When your goal is to get drunk, stick to domestic beer in cans or on tap. Selecting the leading mega brews will not only save your discretionary income for more important purchases like NASCAR season tickets and Rohypnol, but will also allow you to cement your faux solidarity with the common man who might otherwise let the air out of your tires. Also, it's important that you develop the beer gut you will later need to justify the purchase of an expensive red convertible sports car. However, whiskey is not a purchase for getting drunk. Only poets and Englishmen get drunk on whiskey. The purchase of whiskey is made to show off how much money you have. Select a single malt from a town that you cannot pronounce. The vintage should be at least 24 years old and cost as much as a top-end cell phone. Nurse it all night and then complain that it's not as good as the Balmorghi. If anybody asks you what the Balmorghi is, run. All right, welcome back to the Petardcast. I am joined by my first ever lady guest, Olivia Todd. All right, well, why don't you go ahead and identify yourself to my theoretical listening audience. Nice. Tell us who you are and what you do.
Wait, how is your audience? Like, are you getting emails or, like, are you getting listeners back? Okay.
There's probably some way I could find out, but right now I like to pretend that I have an imaginary audience of millions.
Okay. What do you want me to say?
Well, tell people what your name is, where you live, and what you do.
Okay. My name is Olivia, and I live in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, New York City, United States. And I, for a living, I'm just kind of hustling right now. Like, I do a little bit of freelance graphic design here and there. I have a vintage clothing and knickknack store on Etsy. So I just sort of like, I collect a lot of old shit. So I sell it on Etsy when I just get tired of it or whatever. And so I get money that way. And
you are very fashion conscious.
I guess, but not really. But if you ever like, I could never say that. Like, I could never be like, oh yeah, I'm totally into fashion. I know. So I don't know. I know what I like. But I couldn't, like, really have a conversation with somebody who is, like, really into, like, fashion labels and underground independent fashion makers and stuff. Like, I don't know everything, you know? And I feel like when you tell somebody you're into fashion, they expect you to know everything instantly. And they'll quiz you on it, like with anything, I guess. And I'm just like, I'm not too familiar with Chanel from, you know, summer, spring 2000. Like, I'm not really familiar what happened during that time, you know, and I feel like people really expect you to know that, especially if you want to get a job doing that. You know, you have to be a total authority, where I am not, but I enjoy it. Like, I love dressing up and, you know, having a good time with it, with anything, like enjoying anything. But,
do you have any affinity to, fashion design? Is that something you think you could do?
Well, when I was in middle school, I really got into it. And I realized I just started drawing dresses, like on people, you know, like little drawings and sketches and stuff. And I thought, like, everybody does this, right? And then I noticed that my girlfriends that were more popular or cooler or, like, better than me, they couldn't do it as well, or they couldn't do it at all. And I was like, oh, awesome. So this is something I could, this could be something that I could do for a living, or I could do. So I started drawing a lot of dresses and clothing and, like, I don't know, like bathing suit design, which is kind of weird. And like just all kinds of really fun stuff that I wish I could see at stores, or I wish I could see. Definitely costumey, like something you'd see, you know, like a music video or something nowadays or whatever, like really like crazy stuff. But it was really fun and creative and I loved it. And I showed my one of my sisters, and because she could draw really well. And so I thought, oh, we could connect on this, you know. And she goes, yeah, you can't do that for a living. The only famous known fashion designers are gay men, and you're not a gay man, so you're not going to be anything. So just give up. Uh-huh. And I was like, okay. So I just stopped, because like, she was like, you're never going to make money doing that. You're never going to be famous. And she listed off, like, Oscar de la Renta and, like, all these, like, you know, Jean Gonché, like, all these, like, gay, you know, guys, like, famous, known, big, huge.
Yeah, but now you know that there are heterosexual women who do it.
Of course. Now it's total bullshit. But at the time, like, it was, like, in the 80s. And, like, it was Alabama. And my sister, she didn't know anything about fashion except, like, super mainstream big names, you know? And she was... I don't know, but she was older, and like I shared this thing with her, and I thought, well, she must know. She's artistic. She's like the most artistic out of the family that I know of, so she must know something. So I believed her, so I stopped. But
you never had the urge to pursue it again after that.
I don't have the urge to draw clothing so much, but I do have an urge to take apart stuff that I have already. And fix it and like change it around, like change it up and stuff, and like put things together and like, you know, like change hemlines, like simple stuff, like make things fit me better. Like not like I'm going to make clothes to change the world or change the face of fashion, or this is what I think other people should be wearing or what they're going to like. Or I would make clothes that what I like, which is the number one thing you don't do as a fashion. Like, you'll never be famous as a fashion designer, I don't think, if you're making clothes that you want to wear, because that's, you know, I don't know. And I don't think that works out. I think you have to forget that. And you have to have like a team of people, and it's this big thing. And like nowadays, like it's all about branding. So like if you get a little bit famous as a designer, you need to start thinking about like having a perfume and like branching out and like getting a logo on cell phones or something. You know, it's like this, everybody wants to be like Louis Vuitton or somebody, you know, a huge name, like a household name. And I think it becomes less about the clothing so much as like the you know, the whole thing. But that can be applied to anything. Like you can apply it to music and any kind of business or anything. So that's why I really don't like, I don't like that about it. I'm glad I didn't get into it, you know, whatever.
All right.
So
tell me something about Brooklyn. Tell me what you like the best about it and what you dislike the most about it.
I like there's so much going on. Like new ideas and art, music, any kind of media, any kind of anything. Like, I just feel like there's a lot of like really creative people here. And I like that sense of community. Like, I wish I lived, I live not in an artistic community area of Brooklyn. Like, I wish I lived closer to like Bushwick and Greenpoint and a little bit of Williamsburg, even though most of that isn't that like affordable and artistic anymore. But I would like to be more in that setting. Like, I would like to go to a job and then come home and then be like, oh, I had a shitty day at work or something. And I'd love to just like walk down the corner and then go into like a local bar and sit and drink and like just, you know, chat with the locals and like meet people that way. Or like there's so many really great music venues around there, like in Bushwick and Greenpoint and Williamsburg. And I want to go see shows there. Like, there's so many great shows there. Like, every night there's something great happening. Like, in someone's apartment or, like little parties in someone's loft, you know, that just happens one time where a lot of great bands come or something. And I want to go to that, but I think of how long it's going to take me there on the train and then on the way back. And I kind of don't want to be out really late at night as a single girl in certain neighborhoods and stuff. And, like, on my own, I don't want to invite bad stuff to happen, you know. I'm kind of nervous about that. So I don't know. So I mean, that's, and then the bad thing about Brooklyn is the people too. Sometimes it's just, there's so many creative people and there's so many
females that are just like me, and I just feel like I just get lost, you know, in the sea of Brooklyn girls, you know, and are just artists. Like, I wanted, I get an idea for something, and I'm like, this is going to revolutionize the world. This painting or this whatever. And I look online and there's like five girls already right in Bushwick doing the same damn thing. You know, I'm just like, well, and they're doing it better, you know, or, mm-hmm. or their spin on it is much more interesting because they're like, I don't know, cooler in some way or, you know, so that kind of sucks. Like, I feel like, I don't know, but I just wish I was part of the community more though.
Is there any cognizance of, I mean, because if you ask people from outside of New York,
yeah,
what they know about Williamsburg and Greenpoint, they will tell you that's where all the hipsters come from.
Yeah.
The only thing they know about it is that it's the center of obnoxious, like, hipster culture. Yeah. Is there a cognizance of that? Like, living in Brooklyn, do people ever, like, do people embrace that and say, yeah, we're the hipster place? Or do they go, no, that's not it at all. Other people are hipsters, not me.
I think it's a little bit of both. It's weird and strange to me that the whole hipster thing is still going on. Like, I kind of wish it would go away because I feel like it overshadows a lot of the really great things that are coming out of that area. It really pisses me off because I know people see me, like, if I dress up cute or something, like, oh, God forbid I wear a vintage dress or, like, really interesting shoes, or I put a little bit of color in my hair, or I dye it white or something. People are going to see me walking around and they're going to go, oh, look at that hipster bitch. You know, look at that hipster. But she's bullshit. Fuck her. What does she know? You know? And I really don't know where this hatred came from exactly, but it's been around forever. And I feel like it's ever since I moved here. I moved here in 2002, and I feel like it's just everywhere, and you can't shake it. And I just feel like it overshadows the good stuff that's happening. I mean, we're the tastemakers. I mean, we are. Like, we're LA and New York. Like, we tell everybody what's cool and what to do. And I think we have every right to, because we're around awesome stuff. We're creating awesome stuff. I'm not saying people in other cities aren't smart and doing amazing things, because they absolutely totally are. But it's like, for, I don't know, I feel like we can do a lot more than just being hipsters or just being this thing that's hated. I don't know if it's out of jealousy or whatever. And people always bring up the next thing you hear when people say, when they say hipster, they say trust fund. They always use trust fund. I had never even heard the word trust fund until I moved here. Like, I didn't know what it meant, really. Like, people would use the term trustafarian, and I'm like, what the fuck is that? Like, I don't know what that means. And so whenever I hear hipster, then I hear trust fund used in connection with that.
Or douchebag. That's what they're,
No, douchebag is more like New Jersey. Like, when people say douchebag, I don't think they really mean, I don't think it's so much, whenever I hear, well, nowadays, whenever I hear people use douchebag, which I hate that word. I don't like that word. I don't like the word wife beater in reference to a white shirt without, like, an undershirt. Like, why did that happen? Why did wife beater have to happen?
When you're beating your wife, you need the maximum range of motion and comfort.
Obviously. But I mean, like, why? I don't like how that became this accepted thing to say. Like, when I'm in a group of friends at a bar or something, or I'm on TV or in movies or whatever, and I see a woman and she says, "Oh yeah, just pick out any wife beater there," or "Hey, I'm wearing my wife beater. I want to like kill her or something." I don't know. Like, I want that to not be the reality that is the life that I live, that I have to see that. Like, it just kills me that she's okay with that everybody is okay with that. Like, if I hear my mom say that, I will fucking blow my brains out. Like, I don't even, like, I can't believe in that kind of society. I don't know. That just drives me crazy. Like, that's cool to say that anyways. And I feel like douchebag is really cool to say. I don't like that. Not that the, I mean, it's not, that's like a feminist thing. It's just, why? There's so many, you can use so many other, like, I think cunt is better than douchebag. Like, I would rather people say cunt than douchebag, because cunt is awesome. It sounds really great, and you're like, you know, you're making the sound with your mouth. It's awesome, but douchebag. Anyways, so back to the whole thing about I'm sorry, I got that right. You can cut that out if you want.
No, that was good.
No, it's all hurts. I got all mad. But when I hear people say hipster and then I hear them bring the whole money thing up, it sounds like they're jealous. Like they didn't grow up with a lot, and so therefore they think that if they had money, then they would get to do whatever they want. People think hipsters do whatever they want. Everybody I know that gets called a hipster or looks like a hipster, like any friends, anybody that I know, they're dead broke. They're trying to fucking get their creative art with their band, their drawings, whatever they're doing. They're trying to get it seen. They're trying to make a living off that, where they're doing some horrible, horrible job, maybe two other jobs that it's just like this, like just killing them. They're living in a very shitty neighborhood with a lot of crime, with roaches, with rats. It's like total starving artist stuff. And they're like, oh, hipsters, they dress shitty. They're rich and they're trying to look poor. No, we're actually poor. That's why we dress that way. We can't afford to do anything else. Those skinny douchebag hipsters. Yeah, we're skinny because we can't eat, or we're too stressed out to eat, or we may be on drugs. So who cares? But I mean, still, it's like this whole hatred towards something that really doesn't exist.
Yeah, I'm on your side with that. Let's get ready to do a dialogue, shall we?
Victor?
Yes, who is this? This is a private line.
It's Jeanette.
Jeanette, I thought I told you not to call me here.
This is important.
I'm in a very important meeting, dearest. I have the Prime Minister of...
I can't wait.
All right, what is it?
Don't sigh at me.
I wasn't sighing at you, I was just sighing. What do you want?
You say that like it's an accusation.
Darling, please, I'm very busy.
You're always busy. You never have time for me.
Can't you tell this to one of the robots, whatever it is?
I'm not going to be talking to one of the robots right now, for all the good it does me.
What do you want?
I think we should stop seeing each other.
What?
God! Sorry to say, but I guess I had to say it.
You're breaking up with me.
I really think it's for the best.
No one has ever broken up with me before.
See, that's part of the problem. No one ever says no to you.
I do not take such matters lightly.
What I hear you saying is you're afraid of rejection.
I said no such thing.
You're talking about yourself in the third person, aren't you?
No, You're putting words in my mouth. I wasn't going to do anything of the sort.
Honestly, Victor, you might as well say bah.
Why do you do this thing to do... Why are you doing this?
I need more.
More? What more could I give you? I have made you like a queen. I have outfitted you in the finest garments. You have the love and respect, the fear of the people. My vast wealth is at your disposal.
You're not supportive of my career.
Why do you need a career? You have everything you could want. An elegant castle, an army of robot duplicates, digital cable.
Hello? Ever heard of personal fulfillment? There's more to life than money, Victor.
I paid your tuition to Doomstadt Community College.
And all you ever do is make fun of my pottery.
I'm not making fun of it. I just said I don't understand modern art.
Meanwhile, your own career is stagnating.
Stagnating? I am the absolute ruler of a small but prosperous European nation, you know.
You're resting on your laurels. Have you ever thought of going into business?
I invented a working time machine.
And you keep getting defeated by the same four people.
And you keep failing your intermediate algebra class, and your teacher can't lift a tanker truck or create impenetrable force fields. But you don't hear me nagging.
I don't want to turn this into name-calling, Victor. I just want us to make a clean break and fresh start.
Fine. Good luck finding another boyfriend who has his own country.
You're unreasonably bitter, Victor. I should have known not to get involved with a guy who has so many issues with his mother.
I do not have issues with my mother. I'm trying to rescue her shade from the eternal torments of the pits of hell.
And you don't call that an issue?
This is about my face, isn't it, Jeanette?
Oh, God. I knew that would come up.
It's because I'm scarred and hideous and ugly.
And fat.
You're not fat. And the only person bringing up a thing about your face is you. You're a very handsome man and a real gentleman. If you just have some ambition and stop living in the past, and if you learn to listen to people instead of making speeches the whole time, you'd make someone a great husband someday. Just just not me.
So this is it?
Yes, I'm afraid so. I'm sorry.
Well, fine. Thanks for everything, I guess. See you around.
Victor.
What?
Are you this very moment dispatching robot shock troops to my quarters in Castle Doomstadt to carry me forcibly off to the dungeons?
Maybe. So what if I am?
You never learn, Victor. You never learn.
People have asked me, Leonard, why do you call your celebrity news segment Celebrities Are Better? Well, I think that's pretty self-evident because celebrities are better than us. Celebrities are more important than us, and the normal things that we do, when they do them, are important. I mean, if you were important, wouldn't celebrity magazines be writing about you? I mean, you know, when you have a birthday or you have something happen at your job, it doesn't show up in the newspapers. You know why? Because you're not important. Demi Lovato is important. I mean, just think about it for a second, people. Our first story comes from Thursday, from Ted Casablanca's The Awful Truth column. I usually don't like E's coverage because it's a little too personality-driven. You know, there's too much of an editorial voice in it, but news is news, so... Sandra Bullock has had a hell of a year, so we're glad she's not relying on her douche of an ex, Jesse James, to bring home the bacon. Forbes recently released its list of Hollywood's highest-paid actresses, with Sandy nabbing the numero uno spot after raking in $58 million. I can't really do a Ted Casablanca voice, so you're just going to have to imagine that I sound even gayer than I usually do. Naturally, we're intrigued with the babe who rounded out the top 10. Kristen Stewart finished off Forbes' list with a cool 12 mil and was the youngest leading lady by a long shot, sitting pretty next to some of T-Town's power femmes. Totally impressive. I really think that only a gay man can get away with writing like this. You know, a straight man writing like this would just get punched in the face. Obviously, Eclipse has made K-Stew very in demand, but if she didn't have the acting chops to boot, we doubt she'd be there. I don't think Ted Casablanca has watched any of her movies. Plus, we have a feeling, thanks to two Breaking Dawn flicks coming up, she'll steadily be moving up this list. Reese Witherspoon, who hasn't been in a flick on the big screen since Four Christmases, tied at number two with Cameron Diaz, both chicks making $32 million. Who is paying Reese Witherspoon $32 million? Ironically, Cammy's Day and Night co-star Tom Cruise made a Forbes list himself last week for being one of Hollywood's most overpaid stars. That's not ironic, Ted Casablanca. As did Drew Barrymore, who makes an appearance on both lists. Other babes making the cut, Jennifer Aniston, Sarah Jessica Parker, Julia Roberts, Angelina Jolie, who the Mag points out, broke other records, being on 38 magazine covers this year, and Meryl Streep. Not bad company for Kristen, eh? Knew this babe was doing something right. We saw it ages ago. Who is that the royal we that Ted Casablanca is employing? Next up from People on Friday the 12th, I'd like to point out in advance, it took two people to write this article. Jennifer Love Hewitt's new boyfriend cooks a great turkey. Jennifer Love Hewitt says she has reason to be smitten with her new beau, Alex Beh. I don't know if that's how it's pronounced. It's spelled B-E-H, which that doesn't sound like a name. That sounds like a sound effect. He's handsome. He opens doors for her. And he'll come in handy on Thanksgiving. I didn't know he made a great turkey until right now, the actress, 31, told People at the Rock the Casbah Galley in L.A. We're learning every day. So I guess he had just cooked a turkey at the Rock the Casbah Gala in L.A. As she was speaking. That's how she just found out. From John Mayer to her Ghost Whisperer co-star Jamie Kennedy, Hewitt has had enough dating experience to fill a book. And that's just what she did in her advice tome. Jennifer Love Hewitt wrote a tome, folks. The Day I Shot Cupid, published in March. And it's a book the actor, 28, has studied, saying he, quote, enjoyed it, and that it was, quote, a great time. You may recall that this book went into some detail about the process of decorating your vagina with sparklies. The couple cozied up and walked hand in hand on the red carpet, Bess' arm around her waist. But it's not just the glammed up Hewitt he's attracted to, he says. Any look that she has, he tells people of his favorite Hewitt ensemble. Anytime she looks at me. Hewitt is also heeding the advice she dished out in her book in her relationship with Bay, whom she described as an old-fashioned gentleman. I don't even know what that sentence. I got to read that again. Hewitt is also heeding the advice she dished out in her book in her relationship with Bay, whom she described as an old-fashioned gentleman. As she says, quote, I do feel like me kind of writing it helped me to sort of get to where I needed to be in order to know that he was there. That's why this column exists, folks, because how else would you know something like that? I'm going to say it again because I know you all keep a little catalog on your computers of quotes, famous quotes that guide you through your lives. And if this one doesn't belong on it, goddamned if I know it does. I do feel like me kind of writing it helped me sort of get to where I needed to be in order to know that he was there. It's a word for the ages, words of wisdom from Jennifer Love Hewitt. Everybody. Finally, from OK Magazine, my favorite. My very favorite magazine, you know, OK gives you what you want. You know, there's no fucking around with OK Magazine. This one is not by my favorite OK columnist, Mary Sue Quirk. It's by a Brittany Tallarico, but still pretty good. Ashton Kutcher and Scout Willis take Demi Moore for a birthday lunch. See, that's why, again, that's why celebrities are more important than us and better than us. Because ordinarily, if a woman has a birthday and her daughter and her boyfriend take her out to lunch, that's not news. That's a completely banal activity that no one in their right mind would care about. But because it's celebrities doing it, it's important. It deserves space in a magazine. Demi Moore looked a little glum yesterday as she went out for lunch with hubby Ashton Kutcher and daughter Scout Willis. Maybe she was bummed about celebrating her 48th birthday. The actress looked as hot as ever, wearing tight jeans and a black leather coat for the B-Day celebration at Mexicali Cochina Cantina in Studio City, California. Scout donned all black for the occasion. There's a photo of her wearing all black in case you didn't believe him. And Demi held on to Scout, who was busy texting as the trio walked through the parking lot. There's also a link to a gallery where you can see Demi and Ashton standing united against child sex slavery. So they're good people, too. You know, unlike most of us, they are against child sex slavery. Ashton was sure to tweet some sweet sentiments to his beloved and reminded the Twitterverse of her big day. Don't forget to wish at Mrs. Kutcher a happy birthday, he tweeted. Aw, that's sweet. The couple has stayed united through the recent media firestorm surrounding their marriage, claiming that Ashton had an affair. Well, I mean, you know what I say to that is I do feel like me kind of writing it helped me to sort of get to where I needed to be in order to know that he was there. In the history of legendary one-handed blues folk guitarists, there is only one, Anton Googsy Mostyn. Similarly, in the history of Anton Googsy Mostyns, there is only one legendary one-handed blues folk guitarist. For too long, he has been a footnote, less than a footnote, really, more of an endnote or an asterisk which fails to produce a citation, or even a hyperlinked text in a non-digital format. Now, the world will finally hear the sound of one hand strumming. Anton Googsy Mostyn, the nickname originally belonged to his childhood friend Reginald Googsy Shockville, who lent it to him in exchange for a cigarette in 1958 and promptly forgot all about it, was born in 1941 in the obscure tin mining hamlet of Malpuissance in southeastern Scotland. Economically plagued throughout the early part of the century due to a lack of tin to be mined, Malpuissance's sons and daughters led a hardscrabble existence until the outbreak of the Second World War. Mostyn's father, an Anglo-Moravian immigrant who had come to Malpuissance in search of a hidden treasure he'd read about in a badly translated pulp novel, immediately joined the resistance in 1940 after the fall of France. Due to his living in unoccupied Scotland, his heroics were few and far between, and largely consisted of going down to the pub and asking strangers if they wanted any schnitzel. However, his wartime activities cannot be fully discounted as they resulted in two highly desirable outcomes. First, not one single mile of southeastern Scotland fell to the Axis during the entire conflict. And second, he fathered a child, Anton. Originally a two-handed youngster like most of his peers, Anton Googsy Mostyn was preoccupied with most of the normal activities of a boy in his time and place, playing football, chain-smoking, racial hatred, blues records, and blaming his mother for his sexual dysfunction. Even during the post-war boom, though, times were tough for tiny Malpuissance. A plan hatched in 1947 to convert the area's tin mines into uranium mines to satisfy the new demand for atomic energy failed for much the same reasons the tin mines had. And soon, Anton was forced to seek his daily bread like so many other young men of his generation, on the dole. It was here, in the unspeakably brutal daily conditions of the queue, where a man could, in the space of a single two-hour shift, face such horrors as loafer's cramp, oversmoked lung, gossip's disease, and chronic hangabout, that he lost his left hand. It was 1962, and a 21-year-old Anton was waiting for his unemployment benefits and having a bit of fun playing with one of the hot new amusements from America, the flying disc. Unfortunately, his impoverished mates couldn't afford one of the plastic models manufactured by Wham-O, and instead improvised by using a circular saw. One quick jump and toss later, a hand was severed, and a legend was born. Faced with the punishing schedule he bore at work, he was now collecting both unemployment and disability benefits, which often required him to spend as many as 4 hours a day on the queue. Anton Googsy Mostyn decided to take up the guitar as a form of relaxation. He had not known how to play previously, and in fact came from a musically unschooled family. "There was more tin in his ear than in all the mines of Malpuissance," wrote Sandy Fogtrap in his classic 1982 essay on Mostyn, "One Hand Misses the Other, the Sorrow, the Pity, and Anton Googsy Mostyn." Still, he had noticed that other working-class young men were making a bit of cash off the whole pop music racket, and Googsy was a man who liked to do what other young men were doing for money. Soon, he was playing at local venues like the Cavernous Club and the Volcano Lava Surfin' Hawaii Tiki Lounge in Klezmerteria. "His style was completely unique for the time and place," recalls his longtime manager and bail bondsman, Jacques Lurletta, "or any other time and place. Faced with the difficulty of playing a two-handed instrument with less than the recommended number of hands, Mostyn could easily have followed in the tradition of other musicians and developed an idiosyncratic playing technique that relied on innovation, interesting arrangements, and dazzling fingerwork. I suggested that to him," says Lurletta. "His response, as I recall it, was, 'Bugger that for a lark.' He instead chose what later became known as Googsyism." Googsyism, as it was called by noted one-handed guitarist Anton Googsy Mostyn and a number of people he slipped a quid to call it that, was a simple method of playing guitar with one hand by simply ignoring the frets altogether and focusing solely on strumming. While this would seem to be limiting, for example, it precluded tuning one's instrument or playing anything other than an open C, Mostyn let this become a strength rather than a hindrance. He developed a repertoire that fit his abilities, including such signature tunes as Open Sea Blues, Symphony in C, Three Chords Minus Two Chords Equals One Chord, and notorious covers of In C and This Is a Note Called Middle C. He handpicked a small band of sidemen whose ability to play instruments normally and possession of a full complement of extremities helped mask his deficiency. Although easily one of the 10 most seminal one-handed guitarists southeastern Scotland has ever produced, the critics have not been kind to the legacy of Anton Gugsy Mostyn. Who? Is a comment frequently encountered. Never heard of him is another. And he's bloody awful is the other one. Audiences have been equally standoffish. Only 16 people have seen him play at the half dozen shows he's done since the early 1960s. Less than that if one doesn't count the actual members of his band. As a result, his recorded output has been sparse, consisting of no recorded output. All that changes this summer, however, with the release of Googsyism, A Man, A Hand, A Canal, Lanaka de Nahanamamana, a new 4-disc box set from Bounder Records. Consisting of nearly 22 minutes of live performance from the unidextrous Legend of Malpuissance, and over 200 minutes of Mostyn blaming his failure to breach the top 40 charts on his mother and the Jews, Googsyism will satisfy those who love Anton Gugsy Mostyn, those who hate him, and the many, many billions who know absolutely nothing about him. Well, that concludes the latest edition of the Petardcast. Thank you to Ms. Olivia Todd for being our person of interest this week. You can learn more about her at the delightfully named putmoneyinyouridaho.blogspot.com. I hope you'll join me next week for another Petardcast when we'll be adding to the overall anxiety levels of the world with J'accuse, naming of parts, and another special guest who will aid and abet the nameless crime that is this program. As ever, prospective guests may email me at guests@ludiclive.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the Petardcast free of charge on iTunes or listen at any time at ludiclive.com. We're always happy to hear from you at info@ludiclive.com. This episode is dedicated to Burma Jones and Peter Greenaway. Thanks, too, to the human sex drive, the frustration of which is responsible for this, as all other art. I am your host, Mr. Leonard Pierce, and good luck ever getting my voice out of your head.